believing is not always something that we can control directly. I can't just up and decide to believe something. If I see it to be true, I believe it. If it seems not to be true, then I don't believe it. And to be told to believe something that I don't think to be true is not going to help me very much. Or to be told not to believe something that I do see to be true is not going to help much either. You can't believe just based on being told to believe. Believing just happens. Well, or does it? There's a little bit more to it than that. Believing is not just something you can make yourself do or can make somebody else do, but there are certain things that shape your mind and that make you either more likely to believe something or less likely to believe it. And it's important to understand some of these mind shapers for yourself, as well as the impact they can have on other people. Because there are some things we think we ought to believe that maybe we sort of think maybe might be true, but we can't persuade ourselves of their truth. And if we knew some of the shapers of our mind, we might be on the way towards getting a better grasp on reality. Let's think about some things that shape the mind. In this talk, we're going to be thinking about how your social setting shapes your mind. In other talks, we'll talk about how your actions, your pattern of behavior, can shape the way you think and influence what makes sense to you. And also how your heart, the things that move your deepest self, have a powerful influence on what you think and know. But for now, let's focus especially on your social setting, whom you fit in with and sometimes who you fight with, who you react to. Your surroundings, the people you're with, have a profound influence on the way you think. We see this already among little girls. Little girls will play with certain kinds of dolls because their friends do. And they see their friends doing it, and so they do too. When they grow up, they will believe that certain things are in style and certain other things are out of style. And how do they determine that? By what other people are doing. Very few of them create a style on their own. Their belief about what is stylish, their belief about what looks good on them, is shaped very much by the society they're part of and by the circle of friends that they hang out with. If you're going to a school and you have the wrong brand of clothing or the wrong kind of shoes, it may be a real problem because people will believe there's something wrong with you if you don't fit in style-wise. Style is a big part of being shaped by those around us. The Bible says we're shaped by those around us, by those we fit in with. A very brief and telling statement is Proverbs 13, verse 20. Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. That's it in a nutshell. When you hang out with wise people, you're likely to become wiser. When your best buds are idiots, you're more likely to become idiotic. You grow in wisdom in a certain crowd, your IQ shrinks in a different crowd. And it's not just the impact others have on you, but also then you may be having that impact on certain people around you, where if you're wise, it'll rub off on them. If you're foolish, it will rub off on them. One who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. And I could give many more examples from the book of Proverbs, but these make it abundantly clear the impact that your companions, those you hang out with, are going to have on you. And there are a variety of people in our social setting that shape the way we think. Our first and earliest and usually most powerful shapers are the members of our family, our mother, our father. If we have a mother and a father, these days, many families, the father goes missing, but even his very absence can have a shaping impact. But at any rate, your mom and dad have an impact on you. Your brothers and sisters shape who you are. When you're married to somebody, your spouse has a huge impact on the way you think. And after a while, your beliefs can change because of who you married. And so let's think a little bit more about that. A good parental influence is mentioned in the book of Proverbs again and again. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. My son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice. That's part of how a social setting shapes you. You figure out that your dad is very pleased by certain things and upset by other things, and you like to bring him pleasure. He who fathers a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and mother be glad. Let her who bore you rejoice. Good parents and their instructions and their teachings are a powerful influence on what we believe and why we believe it. Sometimes it's treated as irrational to believe something because you learned it from your parents. But overall, God gave his parents for a reason. And many of the important things we learn in life come to us through our mom and dad. When a father calls his family together and they read God's word together, that has a huge impact on the children and on his wife and on himself. And God meant it to be this way. God says, impress these things on your children when you're at home and when you're on the road, when you lie down, when you get up. Your family is to be a social setting for your children and to shape their thoughts and beliefs. And if we grew up in a godly family with godly father and mother teaching us the ways of God and the truths of God, we're much more likely to believe those things ourselves than if we grew up in a family that was actively hostile to the Christian faith. And there is such a thing as bad parental influence. The Bible does say, honor your father and your mother. It says that in settings where your mom and dad are good, pay them very close attention. But also beware of false ideas and bad beliefs that may have come through parental influence. God warns against forefathers and previous generations and their blunders. Do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, nor keep their rules, nor defile yourselves with their idols. If you grew up in a family where idols were worshipped, where there was false religion, then the best thing you can do is not to pay attention to parental influence in that particular setting. God says, do not be like your fathers. They did not hear or pay attention to me. Peter and the other apostles would preach to crowds who sometimes wouldn't listen. Stephen, the first martyr, spoke, and he warned people too. You always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do you. So it's just not automatic that mom and dad are always going to be right. It is just about automatic that mom and dad are going to have a powerful shaping influence on you, and you're often going to follow in their footsteps. The Apostle Peter wrote, you were ransomed from the futile ways of life inherited from your forefathers. A futile way of life. And this is a profound part of our social setting. Either the true beliefs we get from mom and dad or the false beliefs we get from them. And as well, when we become parents, the way that we shape the children whom God gives us. Not only is there parental influence, but another aspect of family is, of course, is the person you marry. Proverbs speaks often of the influence of a great wife, as well as the downside of a wife who's not so great. An excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and she will have no lack of gain. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. There's a story about a woman who had one boyfriend in high school, but she ended up not marrying him and wound up marrying another guy from her high school instead. And then years later, at their class reunion, they were together again. By this time, the woman's husband, the one whom she married, had become a senator and a very influential and important man. And the other person who had been her previous boyfriend in high school had not amounted to very much. And the man said to her, well, aren't you glad you married me? I turned out to be a senator. And she said, if I'd have married him, he'd have been the senator. Well, that's just a story, but here we see her husband is known in the gates and he sits among the elders of the land, but he's that kind of husband, that kind of man perhaps, because she's such an excellent wife and she opens her mouth with wisdom. And many a godly woman has helped her husband to believe many wise and important things, not through nagging. Proverbs warns against nagging and all that sort of stuff. But she has wisdom inner mouth and inner life, and a man is going to be very much shaped by his woman. Now, a woman too by her husband, and that's why it's so important. When you're choosing a spouse, you might just be choosing a whole new way of thinking, a whole new worldview, somebody else's thoughts that are going to rub off on you. So choose wisely, because there is such a thing as bad spousal influence. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who brings shame is like rottenness in his bones. It's better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. There's warning not just about bad wives, but about bad women who aren't your wife but are trying to get you. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. So there's this negative influence as well. And many is the sad story of someone who kind of thought they were a Christian, but married someone who was not, and eventually lost their faith entirely. When your faith is not very strong, if you have any at all, and you marry somebody who's hostile to the faith, it can have an utterly devastating and destructive influence on what you believe. And it's not that you were introduced to new evidence, that new data came your way. It is the person and being with that person that shapes who you are. Again, you're not a thinking machine. You are a human being. And the human beings that you're with will shape your beliefs. You don't wake up one day and decide to believe it necessarily. You just find yourself believing it based on the family members that you grew up in, as well as the person whom you married. Family, of course, isn't the only kind of influence. And Proverbs talks about that quite a bit. In fact, Proverbs chapter 1 warns against a gang. Hey, gangs aren't something new. Young men, toughs who run together and beat up on other people and swipe their goods and get their sense of belonging from their fellow hoodlums, that's a very old thing. 1,000 years before Jesus, Proverbs warns against gangs and says, don't walk in the way with them. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, throw in your lot with us. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Because bad companions can get you to do bad things, but also to think wrong things. Leave the presence of a fool, for there you do not meet words of knowledge. Don't hang out with somebody whom you know is going to have a bad influence on your beliefs. Be not among drunkards, says the book of Proverbs. One way to become a drunkard yourself is to hang out with a crowd of drunkards. And to become foolish is to hang out with a crowd of fools. These days, the power of companionship goes far beyond family. Friendship and even the lure of gangs has always been an issue. But the ability to connect with other people is greater than it's ever been. Not only do you connect when you're with them, but you can be in your own room connecting with lots of different people. Choose the ones you connect with well and be aware of your impact on them. The ability to connect via computer through email and Facebook and other social networking groups has really changed the equation somewhat for kids growing up. Even when they're at home, they're often not at home. They're with their friends. When they're on the road, they're with their friends. And they're texting. They're with certain friends, and then they're texting other friends. And so there's all these opportunities for interconnecting. And it's not to say that these things are bad or that they're evil of themselves. It is to say that companionship has new technology. And this new technology makes the power of companionship even greater in shaping the way we will think and what we believe. Now, people who study sociology, a great authority in sociology such as Peter Berger, they talk about a plausibility structure. Now, that's kind of a mouthful. What is a plausibility structure? Well, the fact is that a system of meaning makes sense and it becomes plausible, it becomes believable within a particular social setting, in a certain society and the people you hang out with. A group's relational ties and its institutions and the traditions of that group, these things socialize newer members so that some things seem self-evident. You don't even question, they're so obvious. And other things just seem downright silly. For instance, if you're born into a certain group of people And you grow up in that group of people, and someone in your group gets sick, one of the first things they will do is to try to figure out who put the evil eye on that sick person. Who cast an evil eye on them and made them sick? Now, if you come from a different social group, you'd say, who in the world came up with such silliness? Evil eye, what a bunch of garbage. We know people get sick because of germs and bugs and biology, not because somebody looked at them in a certain way or tried to cast a curse on them. But if you're part of a particular plausibility structure, casting the evil eye is just an obvious truth. And if you're part of a different group, it's complete nonsense and it's silly. And very many things that we think more than we realize are matters that we believe because of that plausibility structure, because of the way the society around us and the people around us have grown up. And not all of them thought about it. It's something they inherited maybe and partly were shaped by. And so we need to understand a plausibility structure. Now, one of the primary institutions in a modern society is a school. That's a major plausibility structure. In Europe and in much of North America, schools have been structured not to teach Christianity as the truth. It is to be taught instead as a religious opinion among other religious opinions. Darwin's theory of evolution will be taught as truth. The Christian doctrine of creation will be taught as religious opinion. It is structured into the way government schools now operate. And we need to understand that these plausibility structures are going to shape the way that we think. Another institution that's really important is simply various forms of books and other kinds of media that kids have exposure to, the kinds of textbooks that we read in school as well as the things that we read for enjoyment. These are part of the institutions and the things that have been passed along in our particular society. Government is a major part of modern societies. It's a big part of a plausibility structure. Government encourages certain beliefs and discourages certain others. It is the government that lies behind the schools that teach Christianity as mere opinion and many non-Christian things as fact. The role of government and its expanding role, along with the doctrine of separation between church and state, means that government has gotten into more and more areas of life and where people of faith and their beliefs have been forced into a smaller and smaller corner. Now, how does government actually work in what you believe? Certainly not everything you believe is believed just because government says you have to believe it. Again, it's very hard to believe things just on command. But government institutionalizes certain things so that after a while, that setup is taken for granted. For instance, when the government makes a court ruling, it may be a very, very controversial decision at the time with tons of debate, and some people believing it's a good idea, other believing it's a horrible idea. But when the government decides it and forces it to be that way, then after a few decades, that's just the way things are. And almost everybody takes it for granted. It's taken for granted by many in Western societies that the primary education of their children will be done by government schools. It was not always that way. It was pretty controversial when the idea first came out. Now it's just taken for granted. Nowadays, it's taken for granted in Europe that health care is the government's job to pay for and provide. That was once a very controversial assumption. It didn't used to be done by government. Now it's just taken for granted. In the United States, it's a controversial idea that government would get very, very, very involved in health care, but the more it becomes institutionalized, the more it becomes accepted. Now, those are just matters of governing. There have been countries that made the Christian faith illegal and that killed Christians. Some communist countries did that. There are Islamic countries still today where it's illegal to have a Bible, where you will be killed if you convert. And so you live in a society where anti-Christian belief is institutionalized by the practices of government. There are still believers in those societies, but you're not going to be a believer just because you kind of caught on from being in that society and it was the natural thing for everybody in the society to believe. Government has a powerful impact on what is believed and what's recognized as truth. Perhaps maybe even more powerful in government in our thinking is media, movies, film, TV, what captures our imagination, the storytellers that we have, and the things they display. We watch a certain number of movies, and people all behave the same way, perhaps, and they, after a while, give us the notion that the beautiful people all do this. The beautiful people all think this way. And so we are really shaped by media. And when it comes to the way religion is treated, the media can have a powerful impact. For instance, when radio first was invented in the 1900s, the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, government entity, pretty well ran broadcasting, and they ruled that certain kinds of religion could not be on the air, the kinds that were more controversial. And so any religion with kind of sharper edges that warned more about hell, for instance, or that said certain things were serious errors, would not be on the air. And so most of the religion that made it onto the BBC was kind of generic. There were some exceptions and some excellent programs as well, but there was an approach to religion which made it seem that only certain kinds of religion are worth considering. Not even making arguments for it, just making it part of the social setting that you don't even hear the voice of certain kinds of faith on the radio or later on television. These things have a very profound influence on the way we think, and they're part of our social setting, our institutionalized way that our society communicates. And so we need to ask, when we ask, well, what shapes my belief? Why do I think the way I do? Why do I take certain things as certain, other things as totally impossible? A lot depends on what world you belong in. The Bible says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God is. If you're part of a world that ignores God, I mean, it's not just talking about the earth in general. We all live on earth, and it's fine to be on earth and to enjoy life on this earth and the things God has created on this earth. When it's talking about the world, it's talking about a system, a social context that is opposed to God. Do not love the world or anything in the world. And 1 John 4 says, they are from the world, these folks who are opposing the truth of Jesus, and therefore they speak from the world's point of view, and the world listens to them. We are from God. Whoever knows God listens to us. And there he's speaking about us being the apostles of Jesus Christ. There's a certain social setting where we is the world and whatever the world around us is telling us. And there's another social setting where we is the Christians, the apostles, those who believe the truth of Jesus Christ. And if you're from one kind of world, you speak one way and you believe one way. If you're from that other social world, you speak and believe a rather different way. Again, it's a plausibility structure. Your system of meaning makes sense and it becomes plausible within a particular social setting. A group's relational ties, its institutions, its traditions, they socialize newer members so that some things seem self-evident and other things seem silly. And that means we really do have to ask the question, what world forms your worldview? What is my social setting and what's going on in it? I need to understand my family social setting, my circle of friends social setting, and my society social setting with government, school, media, and the institutions of that social world. And here's a very important thing to notice. The Christian community, the Christian family and Christian church, the Christian community is the plausibility structure for the gospel. It's the social setting where biblical belief makes sense. And outside that social setting, the gospel often makes less and less sense because you're in the company of people who do not believe the gospel. In 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul writes a tremendous chapter about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and he writes it because some people are doubting or denying completely that resurrection happens, that Jesus was raised or that anybody else is raised. They're denying bodily resurrection. And at one point, Paul says, "Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals." He says that in the middle of that resurrection discussion. It is their bad company that is making them less willing to believe in the resurrection. Now, we should understand that this is often overlooked. Europe has much less Christian belief now than it did 150 years ago. What happened? Did people discover lots of new evidence and then they decided, you know what, Christianity just doesn't have much evidence in favor of it, and this way of just believing in almost nothing or having a generic belief in maybe some higher power out there or just being an atheist, that's a more sensible way to believe. Many, many people did not think it through at all. I did a lot of my doctoral work in what happened in European belief and behavior over the last 150 years. And here's the fact of the matter, that in most cases, people kept on believing for a while, even after they stopped going to church, and even after they stopped reading the Bible together as a family. They did not stop going to church because they had stopped believing in Christian ideas. They did not stop reading the Bible at home because they said, oh, Christianity is not true anyway. They simply stopped doing those things, and one of their mottos was, you can be a good Christian without going to church. The failure to be involved with God's people and the loss of ritual in the family, daily time of reading the Bible together and praying together and praising God together, these things were given up. And in the wake of giving up that social support for praising the Lord and honoring Him and believing in Jesus, belief followed. A generation or two later, for a while there you'd have one generation that said it still believed something about Jesus and about God. Then the next generation that never was involved in church and where the Bible was not read at home believed less and then less and then less and then less. 150 years ago, 60% of people in Britain attended church. Today, 8% attend church. And as people do not hang around in the company of God's people, they less and less believe what God teaches. So again, there are some people who give up on church because they don't believe the truths that are taught. But in far more cases, they first forsake the gathering of God's people and then they start losing the truths as well. The church is the plausibility structure where the gospel makes the most sense. And that's why Hebrews chapter 10 says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. The church is the place where we encourage each other, and the Christian family is the place where we encourage one another. When you gather together to worship with God's people, the fact that you're there with them means that it's part of God's design. You see, God didn't design us to be individual believers on our own, just discovering all truth for ourselves. Your social setting is going to influence how you think and what you hold to be true. And so you'd better choose your social setting well. Pay very close attention to the family you grew up in and see whether they were in error. But then when you marry somebody, choose the right spouse. When you choose companions, hang out with them and hang out in the plausibility structure of the gospel, that is the church, where you're with fellow believers, where you're praising God, where God's Holy Spirit is helping you to build up each other's faith and confidence and knowledge of God. And when you're in the home, read the Bible. Spend that time, as Deuteronomy says, spending time impressing these things on your children and talking about them constantly, special times of reading the Bible together. These are the things that cultivate the ability to believe. I can't just tell you, hey, you've got to believe this. And if you say, well, I just can't believe, I'm wondering if there might be something to the message of Jesus, but I really can't believe it. Well, then hang around with some of God's people for a while. Hang around at church and see what happens to your ability to believe. It's ultimately going to be the work of God, but more than once a person who hung around with God's people found out that, yeah, they have a way of life and a way of believing that does make sense of things, makes better sense than the other groups I've been hanging out with. And then once you understand the role of these plausibility structures in your ability to believe, in your ability to think and how it shapes your mind, then think about your own influence on others. Again, he who walks with the wise becomes wise. The companion of fools will suffer harm. So you need to be very aware of the impact of others on you, but then also of your impact on others. One who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. And so you, by attending church, are encouraging others to believe. By leading your own family, you're encouraging them to believe. And by getting involved in the wider structures of your society, you can make a difference. If you become a public school teacher, you can be influencing a plausibility structure in a positive way for the Lord. If you get involved in the business world, the way you think and act can rub off on the way other people think and act and what makes sense to them. Don't just think about the books you can read that might have an impact on you. There are some people who are given gifts, and it's the books they can write that can make a difference. C.S. Lewis was somebody who understood a little bit about the role of plausibility structures. He knew the importance of bringing the gospel directly to people and telling them and explaining the truths of the gospel, but he also knew the value of an indirect approach. He called it creating an atmosphere that's more favorable for people to hear the gospel. And one kind of writing that was very popular in his time was science fiction. H.G. Wells and some atheists had been writing science fiction, and Lewis said he would like to claim some of that territory for Christian truth. And so he didn't write a long sermon in that case. He wrote some very interesting and gripping science fiction stories, Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, That Hideous Strength. And in that cosmic trilogy of science fiction, he wrote in a way where his own Christian thinking filled that fiction, and people who read it are just a little more likely to take Christianity seriously when they're finished. Now, he was not only a great imaginative writer, as he did in the science fiction or in his Chronicles of Narnia children's stories, where once again he said that many children, you know, who have a hard time believing Christianity or it just seems boring to them, if it were presented in a little different way, you might steal past those watchful dragons and get a hold of their imagination and open their minds. And that was all part of influencing the plausibility structure of the society. At a different level, Lewis was a great scholar. And so he wrote books such as The Discarded Image, An Introduction to Medieval and Renaissance Literature. And he wrote the Oxford History of English Literature in the 16th century. And he read every book in the whole Oxford Library from that century. He did huge amounts of scholarship and research. And he didn't preach the gospel in such books, but he thought and wrote the way a Christian thinks and writes. And he suggested that Christians could do a lot of good, of course, by direct preaching and witnessing, but he thought they could also do a lot of good by establishing magazines on various subjects and writing books and writing plays and being involved in the media in ways where a Christian message would come through not directly, but in a more indirect manner as people had some of their old prejudices undermined and as they learned to think in new ways. Now, Lewis, of course, is not the only one who has done that. He's an extremely talented person, but God has each of us with a calling. How am I going to, first of all, think within the social context that I'm in? I need to understand the dynamics of it. And then, how can I change the dynamics of it for the better? How can I be an influencer in my marriage, in my family, in my work situation, by being involved with the people of God in the church, helping the wise to become still wiser?